and welcome to a special edition of Risky Talk with Professor David Spiegelhalter. Except that many of you will know I'm not David Spiegelhalter, and not because he's isolated with COVID-19. No, David is here, or rather, at one end of a line with me, Michael Blastland, at the other. Plenty of distance between us. David, welcome to your own show.
No worries, it's grand to be here.
We're doing it like this week simply because the team who make the podcast decided we wanted to hear more from David on Risky Talk, where he's usually asking the questions. This time, he'll be answering them. And what we want to hear about, especially at the moment, guess what? Given that David's a world-leading statistician, are his thoughts about coronavirus or COVID-19, where we are now, what the data we have can tell us and what it can't, and how we should think about the risks. Now, we're having this conversation based on data available up to March the 31st, so do bear that in mind if you're listening far into the future. New evidence is coming in all the time. So, David, a more loaded question these days than it usually is. How are you?
Oh, well, I'm feeling fine. Actually feeling very fit because having this confinement is making me pay a bit more attention to my exercise.
Do you have a sense of personal risk? How risky does it feel for you?
Oh, yeah, not too bad. I wouldn't be, we can come to this later, but I wouldn't actually be too worried about getting it. Oh, I think it could be very nasty, but we'll come back later about what, you know, how can we put our personal risks into perspective?
All right, let's begin with how we should approach the problem, because there are a lot of numbers kicking around. We've got numbers of deaths, we've got death rates, we've got numbers of cases, hospitalization rates, doubling periods, all of that. Which data would you focus on?
It's very true. As you said, I think this is the first, you know, crisis, international crisis like this, where there's been immediate access to huge amounts of data. But it really comes down to, you know, the data that's readily available is on cases and on deaths, and there's a problem with both of them. It's, you know, one of these very basic things that before getting down and doing any fancy analysis, we should ask, what are we counting in the first place? And clearly that, you know, the confirmed case is someone who's actually had a test and been positive. We know that's a very limited view of the actual number of cases out there. People say maybe there's 10 times as many. But of course, it depends on the testing regime. Some countries like Germany have done a huge amount of testing. And so the confirmed cases might represent possibly closer to the people who have actually got it. But other places in the UK, we've only been testing, you know, people in hospital, not even NHS workers. And so actually the number of people that are in this country with the virus is a deeply unknown quantity. So again, with a common testing regime, as long as that's constant, you can use the confirmed case to monitor what's going on. The trends up and down provide some information. If the testing regime changes, of course, that all changes as well. Now, deaths, you would think that deaths would be a good measure, you know, as I put it very crudely, counting the bodies. But we found out increasingly what a tenuous measure that is of the fatal harm of COVID-19. And each country may be different about what it counts as a death. So some countries, it said, are counting deaths where you can actually say this is what caused the death. In this country, we're only just getting clarity from the Department of Health, made public just today on their website, has gone up a description of what these deaths actually mean. That the deaths being daily reported, that coming out on the news, are in fact just, they're just deaths in hospital that have occurred to people who have tested positive. So strictly speaking, if someone tests positive, is in hospital and dies of something else, there'll still be a COVID-19 death. But it doesn't include any deaths in care homes outside. And also, those deaths are delayed. They're not the deaths that happened today or yesterday. Some of them are coming in from 2 weeks behind. Hospitals wait till the family have been informed and given permission. And it seems a bit clear also that they save them up over the weekend and send them all in on Monday. So these numbers are very erratic from day to day.
So we're seeing a bit of a spike on Mondays, are we?
Oh, yeah, there was a spike on me. Saturday and Sunday, the very few went right down. It started declining, the death. So he thought, this can't be true. This is an artifact. And yet suddenly they spiked up in over a day. They went from 180 to 380. No, this is completely impossible from a standard statistical perspective. We know if this was assuming there's some sort of smooth process going on, we know what the variability should be, and it's vastly more than that. So we've got to be very careful in drawing conclusions about what's going on underneath.
Now, given all those uncertainties, and they sound pretty large on all the elementary bits of data that we'd expect to have, can you draw any conclusions about the seriousness of the problem?
One can get a feeling from it that both cases and deaths at the early part of the epidemic in almost every country increased by 30% per day. So if you get a feeling that that's actually the at least the rate of increase is representing what's going on, even if the absolute numbers are undercounts or whatever, if the rate of increase represents, we can really get a feeling of how fast something is spreading throughout the population. And of course, the epidemiologists have built the mathematical models that are being used to make predictions, you know, have been using this kind of data to better inform the models.
So, I mean, I've seen one statistician, John Ioannidis, call it a data fiasco. Despite that, there are things we can say which are, we can say them with some confidence, at least.
Yes, by looking at the rate of change, one can get a lot of information from rates of change. Rates of change are unaffected by perhaps a systematic underreporting. They're unaffected by whether it's done per million or just in the whole country and so on. So all these different metrics make no difference to when we monitor the rate of change. And that is the thing I think that, you know, everyone is focusing on, because we're so interested in whether that rate is declining. In other words, what we'd love to see both in cases and in deaths is that this rapid increase in smooths off into plateaus, into a constant rate, and then falls down as it did in China. And everyone's trying to work out, you know, what is going to happen in the Western countries where the virus has taken off.
So that's one good solid bit of evidence. What about the one that I think a lot of people are concerned with, the absolute rate of fatality? There've been varied estimates for that. I've seen numbers around 0.1, 0.2. The imperial one, I believe, is about 0.9. Is there any way of adjudicating?
It's very difficult. It's very highly contested, because this is the infection mortality rate. In a way, the case fatality rate, which is how many people who we know have got the virus actually end up dying, that can be estimated a bit more firmly. But the infection mortality rate, which is the percentage of people who actually get the infection who then die, depends crucially on, of course, how many people have the infection. And that's the one thing we do not know. In this country, we have to just guess at it until we have some population measures of who's had it. And so eventually we will know rather late. And so the Imperial Group are working by 0.9% as an average. They released an analysis of China a couple of days ago where they lowered that to about 0.65%. But other sources are saying much lower than that, of 0.1% and so on, which is more like seasonal flu. Those studies are influenced by places like Iceland, who measured a lot of people, you know, did a big lot of testing 3% of the population, or whatever, and found a very small number of deaths. But that's Iceland. So, you know, the other thing is, we're assuming that this is some constant number that applies just as much in Iceland as it would in India or somewhere like that. And that is so deeply unlikely, because whether you die or not would depend crucially on the health services available. It'll also depend on how serious the illness is that people have got, their viral load, how much have they been exposed to. Clearly, we're getting multiple deaths of healthcare workers in Italy, which is appallingly tragic. And that is presumably, these are young, healthy people, presumably because they've had a high exposure to the virus. And whereas other places where people live more distantly and are not so crowded in and might have very low exposure to the virus and so actually get a much less severe form of the disease. So I think the idea that there is a infection fatality rate and that's it is pretty inappropriate. There will be big heterogeneity from place to place.
So would you feel confident about making a general comparison with things like normal flu or SARS or 1918 to say simply, is this better or worse?
Well, the standard thing that people said about the comparison with normal flu for a while was that it's twice as infectious and 10 times as dangerous. And I think that is still reasonably strong evidence to have. SARS is different because it's far more dangerous, far more lethal, but actually much less infectious. And so it's actually clamped down and controlled. I'm not sure about Spanish flu. I can't remember the numbers for that. But the crucial thing about that is that it hugely affected younger people. And that is not the case with this disease.
When we look at the various efforts by governments around the world to deal with this, a lot of lockdowns, but not everybody's locking down, and we're not all locking down in the same way. Can we work out which policies are making a difference yet?
Everyone's interested in this, and I don't want to make any grand claims at all. The plots I find most useful, and I'm looking at Our World in Data at the moment because I like their presentations a lot, is one on a log scale of cumulative deaths by country. And there the gradient gives you a very powerful idea of the increasing number of deaths. And lines there that are in parallel are running at similar rates. The epidemic is taking a similar form. And we see, for example, by that the United Kingdom at the moment is running very rather similar to Italy was at the same stage, where Germany, everyone's saying, oh, Germany has got a very low mortality rate. No, it's going along. It's lower at the moment, but its track is exactly the same as the United Kingdom. The very interesting controlled experiment in this sense is Sweden and Norway, because they're next door to each other and they've got very similar population structure, very similar climate and whatever, but have taken extremely different policy views. Norway has implemented quite stringent criteria. Sweden is still really quite relaxed, people going out for meals and no lockdown at all, schools still open and so on. Sweden's progress, although it's lower, it's later, seems to be following the trail of everybody else, of United Kingdom and Germany. Whereas Norway, actually, although it's still really barely started in Norway, is tracking quite low at the moment. So, and of course, we've got Belarus, who have volunteered to be the ultimate control, in which they're taking no notice of the virus whatsoever.
I assume it'll take a little while before we get a clear idea of how those policies have panned out.
Yes.
Okay, well, we've talked about some of the limitations of these numbers, but let's add a few more complications as if there weren't enough, and then some more uncertainties. And so first, there's a lot of discussion whether we're not really preventing many deaths, we're just delaying them, and maybe not by very much, maybe because a lot of people are going to die quite soon anyway if you're already elderly or very ill. What's your view about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting argument, and it's recognized by epidemiologists. It's called mortality displacement, and it's often said that hot weather will do this. It'll just bring on, you know, someone who's frail and vulnerable, an exposure to something like that, like hot weather, will bring their death forward a little bit, known as mortality displacement, or, I've got to admit it, the term that's also used, the technical term, is harvesting.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I suppose it brings up images of the Grim Reaper and things, but that is the technical term. So people have said, Neil Ferguson, the big head of the Imperial Modelling Team, said in evidence to the Parliamentary Committee last week that he thought maybe two-thirds of deaths were people who would probably have died reasonably soon anyway. So there's a couple of issues about that. First of all, it means perhaps that when we come out of this, we'll find that, first of all, the number of excess deaths in the country over the year might very well not be excessive. It might very well look like even an average flu season in terms of the extra deaths.
Really? Within the kind of normal range that we might expect to see?
Well, normal range, normal does very, very much to do with the flu. If an average flu season will bring it up 17,000 or so extra, a bad flu season would take it up 25,000 over the winter, extra deaths, many of whom are, to use the term, harvested from people who would die later anyway.
Although that is assuming lockdown, in saying that it's within what we might expect.
Oh, yes. No, this is assuming, and this is the crucial thing. This is what I dread at the end of this. If these lockdown measures are effective, and the aim is, and it's been made explicit, is to try to keep the deaths below 20,000. And if that happens, and people look back at the end of the year and say, oh, well, not many extra people died anyway, the accusation will be made, oh, therefore we didn't need to do the lockdown, which is not a logical consequence, because it's only 20,000 because we have done taken these measures. The Imperial estimated that if we'd even the mitigation measures, which were in place before the lockdown, it would still have been 200,000 deaths or something like that. Now, that really would make a dent in the population. We have 600,000 deaths a year in this country. We could use that as the norm. So actually, 20,000 extra or 20,000 is within the margins of what can happen in a flu year.
But even if we took two-thirds off 200,000, we're going to see something that's outside the normal kind of variation.
Yeah, with the and the crucial thing, and I think is people do forget this, even though it's been emphasized again and again by the imperial models, by everybody, is that in the end, it's not a matter of saving the lives of some old vulnerable people who are going to die soon anyway. It's the fact that if you didn't do that, if you didn't bring in these measures, the NHS would be just totally overwhelmed, particularly as it's short-staffed. It's going to be touch and go, I think, anyway, whether it can deal with it. I mean, amazing measures being taken at the moment. And just imagine, if this didn't happen, because, for all these deaths, you've got 10 people maybe having to be admitted to hospital, I don't know, so, some measure like that. Imagine the health service totally swamped by this, so that it just fell apart. It just fell apart. Imagine living in a society like that, what we'd feel about that. So it's not a matter of just counting the bodies and saying, oh, well, this is not right. It's the matter of, I think, keeping our respect in society. There are some commentators who have said, oh, well, this isn't cost effective. If we just let all these old people die, we'd be saving all these billions of pounds and we're spending too much to save these lives. And I think, well, there's two answers against that. First of all, if you didn't take these measures, it would be vastly more than this. It'd be vast numbers. But even if you allow for that, Stephen, those numbers would be very expensive. You don't take account of this cost-effectiveness analysis, of which I'm a big fan. The sort of thing that NICE does in deciding about whether to pay for NHS treatments or not, it values a human life, a year of human, good quality human life, at £20,000 to £30,000 a year or something like that. It puts the value, just like the Department of Transport values a human life at about £1.6 million, and that's what they'll spend on road improvements that's expected to save one life. So the value, money is put on the human life. And maybe in the end, we'll have spent more than that to save these lives. But the road improvements and the NHS things are all to do with actually providing benefit to people. You invest in that, and that will give someone benefit. What this investment is to stop people being enormously harmed.
There is there's an old argument that the great benefit, or one of the great benefits the NHS brought, was to lift the sense of fear. That people no longer had to wonder whether they had the resources of their own in order to make sure they were going to live. And that fear is one of those very general, dispersed emotional qualities, which we'd all probably pay quite a lot to get rid of.
Yeah, but just think how fearful you would be if you thought, if you're going to get ill, there's no ambulance that would come, there was no bed available, there was no treatment available for you. You just had to lie at home and suffer and possibly die unnecessarily. And that's what would happen in this country if the thing was allowed to really let rip.
So the articles, I saw one this morning saying that lockdown wasn't worth it, partly for this reason, that, we're probably not saving that many years of additional life, and we're doing so at a cost in lives lost through deep recession that might outweigh the gain. You're not sympathetic.
No, I'm not sympathetic at all. But the one thing in that article I was sympathetic about is that this is not a matter of lives versus money. This is lives versus lives. We really do have to think about the fact that this intervention is itself causing great harm to individuals and to society, both in terms of mental health, we know about domestic abuse, unemployment, poverty, and so on. But as people have written as well, it's a bit like after the financial crisis. It wasn't that financial crisis didn't hurt anybody. What hurt people was the steps taken after it in order to return to normal. Those austerity steps, which people can argue about what the impact was, but it was no doubt huge in terms of the public health. I believe that. And similarly for this, the crucial thing about this is about the harms done after this. Obviously, there are very short-term harms in terms of employment and so on. But the harms, whether this is the long-term harm, is not determined by the epidemic. It's determined by what is done after the epidemic.
In the end, how will we know how dangerous the virus has been overall? Do we have to look at all-cause mortality? Is that the something really big in the round, you know, some great aggregate calculation?
It's going to be very difficult. And I think we will be looking at excess deaths at the end of this. And as I said, I think at the end of it, the excess deaths may not be that huge. We'll have various numbers. We'll have the number of death certificates on which it's been written. And that data is coming in now, very valuable. And we'll have the number of cases that have been reported from hospitals. We will have these sources. But in the end, I would predict that it's not going to make a big dent in the overall mortality of the country.
Thinking about this, as you said right at the beginning, in terms of your own sense of personal risk, can you give us an idea? I mean, let's assume that the numbers we've got are ballpark okay. Can you put them in the context of all the risks we run in normal life and say how the risks to you compare with David Spiegelhalter's normal life, say, a year or two ago?
Yeah, I did this and I was amazed, and it's helped me enormously in dealing with my own feelings about this, is that I was using the mortality rates, the infection mortality rates, published by Imperial College, which may be a bit high, but I use those. And they rise incredibly steeply with age, exponentially with age. And then I thought, well, you know, what else rises? Well, our normal risk rises exponentially with age. And it's amazing. If you draw a graph of what the average risk of somebody of each age is in the country, and you can get that from government life tables, and you plot these COVID risks on top of it, they go almost along the line. It is staggering. And what this means is that essentially, if you get, you know, the COVID-19, the risk of dying is very roughly equivalent to the risk you'd normally have over the whole year. It packs a year's worth of risk into the few weeks that you've got the disease. And so, and that kind of puts it in perspective. What it shows is that this is a relative risk. Whatever risk you've got at the moment, it ups it enormously for that short period. If it's 3 or 4 weeks, then maybe that's 15 times your normal risk. And so suddenly we can really understand why frail, vulnerable people are at such high, you know, so dangerous for them, because they're pretty at risk anyway. And suddenly over this period, it shoots up. They get a whole year's worth in less than a month.
So you say you found this reassuring.
Oh yeah. Oh, because I think I'm very fit and healthy and I'm invincible, and so I'm not that worried about dying in the next year, so I wouldn't get that worried about dying from COVID-19.
So if you're a 60 something looking at the risk that you would have had of not making it from one birthday to another.
Yeah.
That's about the risk squashed into a couple of weeks that you experience if you get COVID-19.
Exactly, very roughly. For adults about 25.
So if it didn't worry you before.
Yeah, you shouldn't be that worried about getting the disease. But if you're actually old or vulnerable, frail, and realize that, you know, you're really thinking, well, my life is limited, then this is obviously deeply worrying. And that's why, of course, people, you know, are being shielded, because these are the very people who it's going to affect.
Now, it should be clear, when we say it's the same as normal risk, we don't mean that it's instead of normal risk.
No. If you survive this, you're still going to go through the whole year as well.
So,
yeah, I'm afraid it doesn't take it away. You don't become invincible for the year if you survive COVID.
Okay, although then we've got to adjust that, possibly, if we say that maybe you wouldn't have made it through the year anyway. So there will be some overlap with those people who are going to die anyway.
Yeah, there will be some overlap for the very vulnerable people, yeah.
Can we talk about it in terms of life expectancy?
Yeah, I thought about that. Well, not really, because I don't think you can do that easily, because it's this short-term impact. It's a real pulse of risk you're having to take at once. So it's not... I don't think it works well in terms of life expectancy. And it doesn't work well in terms of, you know, just a percentage chance of dying, because that varies so much between people. It's almost pointless in mentioning it. It just multiplies your standard risk by a certain amount.
For quite a lot of people, I can imagine that putting the risk like that, it will suddenly feel rather unremarkable, even for some of those in a reasonable state of risk, you know, 60 something, and they think, well, I wasn't afraid before. Maybe I'm not afraid now. Can you explain how that kind of risk can result in so much pressure on the NHS if it seems unremarkable?
Oh, just because you've got vast numbers of people. Essentially, you know, if everyone got it in the country, you'd have a year's worth of deaths in a month or two. You'd have a vast, again, pulse of pressure because all this risk is being packed in together. Spread over the year, we can deal with this risk.
Finally, just looking to the end game, is your sense that unless a vaccine is discovered, we might be expecting the same number of deaths eventually? And what we are trying to do is just flatten that curve and spread them out so that we can cope with them. Or do you think we might actually be able to suppress it in some more permanent way?
An integral part of the modelling by Imperial College was the assumption that we could space out the impact of this virus by starting off with very stringent measures, then relaxing them, and then expecting that there would be a resurgence, and then having to bring in some measures again, maybe not the full lockdown, and so on. And so it makes a sort of forms a wave of bringing in measures and then relaxing them in order to stop the hospital system being overwhelmed.
David, thank you for helping us get a handle on what all these numbers mean and for your own frank assessment of just how much we still can't be sure about. Glad to feel that you're not too worried. I have to say I'm not too worried either, and I'm supposedly at high risk. For those who are worried, I hope there's at least some evidence in this podcast. Thanks very much indeed.
Risky Talk is produced by Ilan Goodman at the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in the University of Cambridge.